Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello once again, everyone. I'm your host, Ray Shasho, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends on BBS Radio. Brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Danny Goldberg, president of Gold Village Entertainment, has worked in the music business as a personal manager, record company president, public relations man and journalist since the late 1960s. Gold Village Entertainment was formed in July 2007 and marks the return to artist management for Goldberg. His latest book is Serving the Servant, Remembering Kurt Cobain. Goldberg's previous books included How the Left Lost Teen Spirit, Bumping into Geniuses, My Life Inside the Rock and Roll Business, and In Search of the Lost Chord, 1967 and the Hippie Idea. From 1983 through 92, Goldberg was the founder and president of Gold Mountain Entertainment, an artist management firm whose clients included Nirvana, Hole, Sonic Youth, Bonnie Raitt, the Allman Brothers, Ricky Lee Jones, and more. Directly prior to the creation of Gold Village Entertainment, Goldberg had been the CEO of Air America Radio from 2005 until mid-2006. Goldberg formed the independent label Artemis Records in 1999 and ran the company until January of 2005. Earlier in his career, Goldberg formed and co-owned Modern Records, which released Stevie Nicks' solo albums, including her number one album, Belladonna. And prior to that, Goldberg was vice president of Led Zeppelin's Swan Song Records and worked with the band from 1973 through 75. In 1980, Goldberg co-produced and co-directed the rock documentary feature No Nukes, starring Bruce Springsteen, Bonnie Raitt, and Jackson Browne, among others. In 2004, he was the executive producer of the documentary about Steve Earle, Just an American Boy. He was executive producer of the multi-platinum soundtrack of music from the television series Miami Vice and was music supervisor on numerous feature films, including Dirty Dancing. Serving the Servant, Remembering Kurt Cobain by Danny Goldberg can be purchased now at Amazon.com. Please welcome President of Gold Village Entertainment, personal manager, record company president, public relations man, journalist, and author, Danny Goldberg, to Interviewing the Legends. Hey, Danny.
Hey, thank you so much. What a generous introduction. That all happened over the course of 50 years, so I don't want you to think I kept changing what I was doing every 5 minutes. It's very gracious of you to go down that long list. It didn't seem at the time like it was going to add up to such a blip. You know, you just do one day at a time, but I'm really happy to be talking to you.
Well, congratulations, man. You've done everything I've always wanted to do. I was an entrepreneur before I was a music journalist. I owned a couple of businesses. I was in the banking industry. But, you know, I'd like to go to the next, you know, I had a chance to manage a local band, but you did it all, man, and I give you lots of kudos for that.
Well, thank you. Like I said, it's happened over a very long period of time, but here we are.
Here we are, huh?
So what should we talk about?
Well, first of all, why do you think Kurt Cobain influenced so many people?
I think because he was uniquely talented, in various ways. You know, he was an innovator in terms of musical vision, because he figured get out of way of kind of taking a lot of the energy of the punk rock subculture and combining it with the language of mass appeal pop and rock and roll, so kind of created a new sound and opened the door for a lot of other artists. And he also was somebody who had a lot of commitment to certain values, you know, kind of redefined masculinity in the context of rock and roll, away from the macho stereotypes towards a more compassionate, sensitive option of what a rock star could be. So I think between what he stood for culturally and his music, you know, he was unique, and certain subsequent artists were influenced by him, as happens, you know, when you've got that kind of talent.
Yeah, he was kind of the people's rock star, wasn't he? You know?
I think he did really, you know, have an unpretentiousness about him. He never wore designer clothes. He never wanted to hang out with celebrities. He was always trying to see things through the lens of his fans, because he remembered so vividly his own teenage years and what music had meant to him in terms of making him feel less isolated. So, yeah, he was certainly of that ilk.
You know, I'm a firm believer that period of time in the 90s, you know, grunge rock, you know, the Soundgardens, the Pearl Jams, System of the Downs, all those guys. That was probably the last time we had anything that resembled rock and roll. You know, after that, it was all done, you know?
Well, I think there's still a lot of good rock and roll music being played, and some artists have good followings, and, you know, bands like The National, and we could go down a long list. But I think that was the last time when rock and roll also could be mass appeal pop music.
Right.
You know, hip hop and dance and other kinds of pop really replaced that piece of it. So now rock and roll is kind of like a niche genre, like, you know, blues or folk. I still love it, and you can still go to concerts, you know, to hear rock and roll that thousands of people will go to. But that form of music is no longer at the center of the cultural zeitgeist the way it was kind of between the Beatles and Nirvana. You know, hip-hop really ascended right afterwards.
Yeah, it was accepted commercially, which you don't hear any kind of thing resembling rock on commercial radio anymore. You know?
No, you don't hear rock and roll that also have pop songs.
Right.
That's right.
Right. And the cool thing about Nirvana is, you know, even if Kurt liked it or not, they were accepted I don't remember if they were on Top 40 radio, but they were pretty damn close. You know, they were accepted.
Oh, no, they were definitely. First of all, Kurt cared very much about this. He didn't like all the results of being famous.
Right.
But he was very competitive and very thoughtful about accomplishing mass appeal success. That's what he aspired to. This did not happen by accident or against his will. He thought about it. He knew what the singles were. He remixed them. And songs like Teen Spirit and
right.
In Bloom and Come As You Are and Heart-Shaped Box and Lithium, those songs were all on Top 40 radio. Smells Like Teen Spirit, I think, was, you know, top five single around the world, not just a rock hit, but was a pop hit also.
I was a Top 40 DJ back in the late 70s. I was fortunate or unfortunate to play the first commercially accepted rap song on the air, which was the Silver Hill Gang. You know,
sure, that's a great, was that White Wine, what was it called?
Rapper's Delight.
Rapper's Delight, what a great song, yeah.
Yeah, it was like, what, 1979, I believe. And
yeah. There
was controversy between her and Blondie with who had the first commercially accepted rap song. But,
I think Sugar Hill Gang was more rap, and Blondie was using some rap influences,
right.
But wasn't really a rap song.
Yeah, I agree.
He was not a rapper.
I agree with you. Now, here's the question, and, you know, I think he did, but do you really believe that Kurt killed himself? There wasn't anything else behind it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So all the conspiracy theorists can go ahead and shut up about it.
I think it's a very small group of people who
right.
who take that seriously, and the facts don't support it. The Seattle Police Department has absolutely no reason to
right.
cover up any wrongdoing, and they investigated it, and then after a few years, when there were some of these people online, woman to have done wrong, and there was no motivation for anyone to kill him, you know. He prone to depression. I saw him just about 10 days before he died, and he was in bad shape. And it's heartbreaking. He was, you know, had prone to depression, prone to drug addiction. You know, so many of us tried to get him into 12-step programs, introduce him to different doctors, therapists, suggested everything that we knew of at the time. And unfortunately, he was in that category of people who it didn't work for. A lot of people, lives are saved by that stuff, but not everybody. I think 60,000 Americans killed themselves last year, three-quarters of them male and half of those with guns. It's a heartbreaking part of the human psyche, and the one which nobody that I know of has figured out, but I believe that's what he did, unfortunately.
Yeah, the scary thing is all those great bands, too, from the 90s, you know, Chris Cornell and... You know, it's very sad. It really is.
Well, there's a weird confluence over many, many decades between great creativity and self-destructiveness.
Right.
It certainly didn't start in the 90s, but you're right. There's a few great artists from the 90s who did it. Obviously, I grew up in, you know, I was in high school in the 1960s. And,
right.
And a lot of my heroes, like Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin,
sure.
Jim Morrison died young. And earlier than that, you know, Billie Holiday and Chet, you know, just great jazz musicians and, you can go back to Vincent van Gogh.
Yep.
You know, it's just, it's one of these weird mysteries of the human mind, and it's really a drag that some people who give us so much are in so much pain. But he did give us a lot, and I try in my book to focus on his life more than his death. I obviously can't avoid his death. It's this grotesque reality. He died so young and so violently, but he was not depressed all the time. He had a brilliance about him. He was very kind to the people around him. He was very, very kind to me, and I just wanted to capture the creative side of him that made him somebody we still talk about. We don't talk about him because he's dead. We talk about him because of what he did when he was alive.
Well, you did a great job in the book. I love the book, and you know, it really told the true story about him. You know, I mean, you were honest. You said he was a slob, ate junk food, wore his pajamas during the day. You know, and you know, you got to be real. You can't sugarcoat the whole thing. I mean, we're all real.
No,
people.
But he was the smartest artist I ever met when
right.
it came to
right.
what he did. You know, I mean, he had no formal education, but when
right.
it came to rock and roll and music and understanding how to communicate with multiple audiences, how to make records, how to do videos, how to do interviews, how to connect deeply with people in a way that really mattered to them. The hundreds and hundreds of decisions he made, 99% of them were good ones, and that's why he's so influential. I think other artists look at what he accomplished the way, you know, the way they look at John Lennon or Bob Marley or Dylan, Springsteen, you know, a handful of the greats. He was on that short list.
Yeah, I agree with you. But one thing you mentioned too also is he was very isolated as a kid. What ways was he isolated from his parents?
Well, you know, he I didn't know him when he was a kid.
Right.
I met him you know, about a year before Nevermind came out, when he was, you know, when he put out an indie record. But it's widely documented, you know, his parents divorced when he was nine.
Right.
It was very painful for him. He was kind of abandoned by both of them and shuttled between different relatives. And then in school he was this brilliant kid. But it's a logging town with a lot in Aberdeen, a tiny little logging town. He was physically small. He was sensitive and brilliant and, you know, didn't have a lot of friends. He was befriended eventually by Chris Novoselic, and the two of them, who was a couple years older than him, and the two of them formed Nirvana.
Right.
But you know, he really, you know, didn't fit into the mainstream, you know, Americana of the 80s, you know, when, you know, he becomes 13 years old in 1980 and Reagan's elected president and, you know, he felt like an outsider. Millions of kids did. He identified with the punk rock of the 80s that was kind of a statement against the status quo, both politically and culturally, and, that was the music that kind of psychologically kept him alive as a teenager and that he emulated initially, but he also had this other side of him that loved a great pop song, so he combined that rebellious attitude and empathy for outsiders and outcasts with a love of great music, and that was the genius of Nirvana, you know, the combination of those things.
You know, I know I like John Lennon, and you know, the song that always came out to me sounding very Beatles was About a Girl. Do you get that?
Well, I did, and that was the first pop song that he kind of that was on Bleach, which was an otherwise, you know, prototypical grunge record.
Right.
The whole album was made for $100,000. But he had always had that side of him, and he talked about that song when later on, when people said that Nevermind was kind of this big change, he said, well, look, on the first record, I already wrote this song about a boy, you know, so that was always part of the menu of musical ideas that were inside his head. So that was definitely the first time publicly he did something that showed the audience that he had that talent in addition to the intensity that he could bring on the punk side.
Yeah, I love that song. I think it was great. You know, I remember, I think he do it as a, oh crap, I'm losing it. I'm going to show you my age now. when they were doing it, without the electric guitars and everything,
Unplugged.
Unplugged, yeah.
I think he did, you know.
Thank you.
it's a song that he was very proud of. I mean, you know, Nirvana only made, you know, five albums.
Which
and that
amazing.
Includes
yeah.
one that was a compilation of outtakes and so on, you know, while he was alive, if you include Unplugged, which was
right.
released after he died. And, you know, for Unplugged, you know, it came out a few months after In Utero. He didn't want to just do the same thing that everybody else did on Unplugged, which is to just play their rock hits with acoustic instruments. You know, he wanted to, he wanted to have it be a creative set all of its own. It would stand on its own feet. And yeah, the first song that Unplugged broadcast in the same sequence on the record was About a Girl.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I liked Unplugged. I think that was very powerful, by the way. I think it
I think it's an incredible performance and one of the great albums. I think a lot of people I talk to, it's their favorite Nirvana
Me
album.
Too.
There's certain,
yeah.
you know, the way he did the David Bowie cover of The Man Who Sold the World and some of the other songs and the Lead Belly song at the end where you
yep.
sleep last night. And that version of All Apologies is what MTV then used as a music video for All Apologies. The song, you know, was on In Utero also, but the acoustic version is what was on MTV a lot. And, you know, that album was number one, just like the two previous Nirvana albums.
So MTV was pretty kind to Nirvana, would you say?
Yeah, they were great to each other.
Right.
But there's no question that when Nevermind came out in the fall of 1991, MTV was at their peak of influence. I mean, it was the one national way that you could reach a big music audience. That video of Songs Like Teen Spirit, that was all his idea and his vision and his, you know, was so impactful that the video was a big part of what made that record so big. And he watched MTV a lot and
mm-hmm.
he cared about it and he made sure that he would do the shows of theirs and the award shows and other things that they wanted to do even if he wasn't in the mood because he wanted them to play the videos. So they were instrumental in bringing Nirvana to a
yeah.
mass American audience.
Yeah.
And at the same time, once they had that hit, they were good for MTV because they became one of the core artists that could
right.
get them ratings and so on. So that was a close, mutually beneficial relationship.
Is it true he wasn't really happy with the performance, though, of Unplugged?
Well, he tended to be incredibly hard on himself
yeah.
in general after
right.
performances. The majority of times whenever I would go and see him in the dressing room after a show, he'd be lamenting some mistake that he made or a broken string or, you know, others talk about them always saying how they suck. So I was not at the Unplugged taping because it was in New York and
right.
my wife at the time was 8.5 months pregnant with our son who would be born 10 days later and
right.
I didn't want to be out of town when my son was born. So I, but Janet Billick, who worked closely with me, and Amy Finerty, who worked for MTV, I both spoke to about the Unplugged for the book, and they said that he was very right afterwards, he said, oh, we sucked, and people were so quiet, and they said, no, you're crazy, they were quiet because they were so in awe. And by the next day, when I spoke to him on the phone about it, he was proud of it and knew he had done good. It's just, that was his pattern, was to be very hard on himself.
Yeah, you know, I interview a lot of, you know, like mainly classic rock legends, and I bring up a lot of new artists as well, but they're all pretty damn hard on themselves, which, you know,
it seems to get into the territory of being a perfectionist. I mean, look, Kurt knew he was good.
Right.
And Kurt knew Unplugged was good once he internalized it. But to accomplish that kind of excellence involves, you know, being hard on yourself and having high standards. And, you know, it's a thin line between perfectionism and self-hatred.
Yeah.
And, some of the greats can go on one side of the line or the other, depending on what day of the week it is. But I don't think you accomplish great things without having high standards for yourself.
Yeah, I interviewed Keith Emerson, you know, from Emerson, Lake & Palmer, and that another sad case, you know. He killed himself as well. We had a great interview together. We talked for like an hour and a half or so, but, man, you just never know. You just never know.
No, he was a great innovator, you know. Yeah. In those days, there were no rock and roll keyboard players. He expanded the art form, no question about it. Keith Emerson did. I never met him,
right,
but I have a lot of respect for him.
Yeah, he just couldn't play the same way, you know, he's used to, and I think he injured his hand or something, and that was it. If he couldn't play like he wanted to, he wanted to end his life, which was very, very sad.
Well, yeah, I hear you.
Yeah. But, you know, like you said, you know, I've got my favorite cousin died of drug overdose. You know, and me and him, you know, we were very close. We partied. We saw the concert together as a kid. I have my best friend actually committed suicide. So I understand all these things. And
you
really can't, it's very hard to save people. Even if you see the signs, it's still kind of hard to save these guys.
You can try. And I think we're morally compelled to try.
Right.
You do the best you can. But you got to recognize what's in your control and what's outside your control, you know, and that's just part of life.
Well, especially with drug use. I mean, that's, you know, how many times, Chuck Negron is a perfect example, but, you know, he came through with it, you know, from Three Dog Night. I don't know if you read his book.
Oh, yeah, no, I've worked with Steve Earle for 20 years now.
Yeah.
He's been sober 25 years.
That's incredible.
I worked in the past with David Crosby, who really, both David and Steve were so screwed up, they ended up in jail earlier in their life, but they turned it around and had incredible lives. And similarly, Eric Clapton and Keith Richards, many, many artists have come out of drug problems, and many non-artists too. I mean, you go to AA meetings or NA meetings, you know, there's millions of people whose lives have been saved in coming out of it and being inspired by the spiritual path, just self-preservation, the love for people around them, the intelligence or whatever. And then, unfortunately, there are others that don't. But thank God there are a lot of positive examples as well as the dark ones that we've mentioned.
And unfortunately, today they're mixing the fentanyl with heroin, which is horrible. Oh, my God. I don't think they did that back in the day, right?
Well, I mean, I don't think it existed.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not a scholar about pharmaceuticals or opiates or anything like that, but I think that's a relatively new breakthrough. You know, and I think there's obviously medical uses, but the potential for abuse is great. You know, I might say, look, there's the availability of guns.
Right.
You know, has a real impact on the death rate.
That's
in terms of suicide, because that's other forms of attempted suicide, you might survive, you know, as opposed to that. But I don't know what one can add to the. I don't have anything to add to the collective awareness of all this stuff that's out there.
Yeah, it's a very tough subject. It really is. Yeah, you know, a few songs were kind of. This is, I guess, for the conspiracy theorists, but you know, like "Come as You Are," "No, I Don't Have a Gun." I mean, I don't know if these were coincidences or he was thinking about that. But also, you know, Smells Like Teen Spirit, you know, a denial sounds a lot like Let Me Die Young. Has anybody told you that? On that too?
You know, I mean, people hear lyrics in different ways, and a lot of people write lyrics about death that don't kill themselves. You know,
right.
A lot of people use imagery about guns and don't actually kill themselves. There's no question that there were, you know, those were themes that you could hear in some of Kurt's lyrics, you know. But, you know, he was a poet, and his lyrics, I never felt they were intended to be taken literally. They were part of a feeling he was generating, and to me, the positive side of Kurt, one of the positive sides of him was his art and his music, and it made people, I think, feel that those feelings of despair or alienation were not only there, that other people were feeling that too, and it made people, you know, feel, less alone. But, you know, there's no question that those were themes that, you know, were there. And in the music video for Come As You Are, which again, Kurt storyboarded, almost all the music videos, I think the first image is of a gun.
Yeah. He collected guns, didn't he? Didn't he have a bunch of guns?
Well, I never knew that at the time. I would have definitely been freaked out if I had known, because I think that somebody with drug problems and guns are a particularly bad combination,
right.
And depressives and guns are. But I later learned that he collected them, but he did have them at different times in his life, especially once he was in the big house in Seattle, and then got rid of them and then got another one. But in my relationship with him, I was never made aware that he had guns until I learned that he was dead.
Yeah, I'm not a big gun nut myself, and you know, I don't advocate hunting as well. I don't believe in killing animals, but and that's why I probably couldn't have a one-on-one with Ted Nugent, even though I did interview him, but we didn't talk about any of that stuff.
Yeah, you know, it's look, I think I don't have anything intelligent to say about all this. You know, I'm a left winger politically. You know, I think that it's too easy to get, you know, for the
it's too easy,
guns,
right.
But I think that people with money are always going to be able to get things you're not supposed to get, and Kurt had plenty of money.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the reality of it.
Yeah. Danny, I want to talk about you because you're a very interesting guy. I've talked to a lot of producers and management. I've talked to Peter Asher, you know, about Linda Ronstadt and James Taylor, and you've managed so many people. What is the duties of a manager, an entertainment manager, to an author? I'm sorry, to an artist.
Well. It's never exactly the same with any two artists or any two managers, because each artist is looking for something slightly different, and different managers have different strengths and weaknesses. In general, it's the person in an artist's career who is the oversees the various different things that they do. A musical career in particular, a lot of artists have multiple careers. For example, they have a songwriting career, they have a recording career, they have a performing career. Those are three different businesses. There's also a lot of artists have international careers. Nirvana certainly did, and a lot of people I work with today do. And so the coordination of strategy between the United Kingdom, France, Latin America, Australia, Canada, America, that becomes a thing. There's trying to oversee the negotiations of deals to help the artists get their best paid the best on any deal. You know, artists have lawyers that do the fine print, but in many cases the managers negotiate the broad terms. My background is in journalism and publicity,
right.
So I've always had a deep involvement in the imaging, how artists relate to the media, what their narratives are. More and more artists today also are involved in other forms forms of entertainment. Steve Earle, for example, who I manage, has written a novel. He's written a book of short stories. As an actor, he's been in some HBO series. So, you know, a friend of mine who shares office space with me is named Mark Spector, and he's managed Joan Baez for the last 30 years and has Graham Nash. And, you know, just talking about the book with him, I said, how do you define what a manager does when people ask you? And he said, I just always think, you know, the buck stops here.
Mm-hmm.
It's ultimately whatever the problem is of the day, whether it's a, you know, promoter canceling a show because they can't pay the advance, or an amplifier being lost in, on an airplane, or somebody getting sick, or dealing with the media, or trying to solve a financial problem for a client, you know, it ends up on the manager's desk. And, you know, it's the person that usually gets the first call when there's a problem, and hopefully you try to anticipate them. But as I say, there are managers whose background are legal and mm-hmm. see things more through a legal prism, some who are accountants and see things more through a financial prism, some who are musicians and, you know, work record and studios. You know, managers come from different walks of life, and my own approach, as I said, has always been seeing things through the prism of the marketing and imaging, because that's kind of my background. But, you know, it's pretty much whatever they want you to do. The word manager is deceptive, because it sounds like we're in charge of something, but we work for the artists. Mm-hmm. The artists are in charge of us.
Yeah.
And then we manage on their behalf their relationship with the rest of their career elements.
Now, your mentor was Peter Grant, and you also admired Kenny Laguna, who's, you know, Joan Jett relationship for a long
time. Well, Kenny Laguna is a friend of mine and someone I admire enormously.
Yeah.
Kenny has managed Joan Jett for 30 years.
Right.
He's done an incredible job. One of my favorite exemplars, and he has skills I don't have. He started as a songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's in Tommy James and the Shondells, and he can produce records. He can play musical instruments. I can't do any of those things, but he's done an unbelievable job for Joan. Peter, I worked for in my early 20s. I became Led Zeppelin's publicist.
That's awesome.
And then they hired me to work just full time for their label Swan Song. That was in the, you know, kind of between 73 and 76. And he was the first manager I really got to know and work with closely. I'd met other managers, Steve Paul, who managed the Edgar Winter and the Johnny Winter Band, was somebody I looked up to a lot. Talbot Grossman, who managed Dylan back in the day and later had the band, is somebody I worked briefly for at a distance. But with Peter, was my direct boss. It was a small group of people who ran Zeppelin. They were the biggest band in the world. And when they came to America, you know, it was kind of me and him sitting in the back of the limo. And I learned a lot just watching him.
Yeah.
How he was such a fierce advocate for the artist that it was no question about who came first. That his concept of being a manager was to just worry about what did the artist want, and what did Zeppelin want, and particularly what did Jimmy Page want, and not to worry what the record company wanted, or the concert promoter, or the media, or somewhere at a hotel, or a driver. It's all about, you know, what the artist wants matters. Our job is to be there for them, to advocate for them. None of this business would exist without them. And that clarity about the importance of the artist, both in terms of negotiations, in terms of attitude, just stayed with me, even though I have a very different style and background from Peter.
Right.
Being around him for a few years was like, you know, the Harvard of managers.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of the great innovators of expanding the power of artists relative to the rest of the business. And to just inhale that attitude from him helped me the rest of my career and to this day.
Yeah, he was an intimidating guy up until the point, I guess, when you lost all that weight, but you know, he didn't take crap from anybody.
Yeah, I don't have... Again, he was a former professional wrestler.
Yeah.
Over 300 pounds. He could physically intimidating. I don't have any of those qualities. So that's something I couldn't learn from him because I wasn't born with that DNA. But I did learn a way of thinking about the business from him.
Also, you managed... You had Belinda Carlisle. You had Bonnie Raitt, which, you know, I'm originally from the D.C. area, so all these guys I knew from, you know, like the Cellar Door, and, you know, I grew up, you know, watching all these guys always coming through D.C. As a matter of fact, I was going to manage, I don't know if you know Skeeter Thompson, he worked with, he was in a band with David Grohl called Scream in D.C., because David Grohl was...
You know, I've heard of Scream,
did
I didn't know Grohl at that time.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, I was not that close to Grohl even in Nirvana, just because the dynamic of the relationships where I would end up being closer to Kurt, and there were certain divisions there I kind of described the nuances in the book. But Scream, obviously, I heard about a lot because of the, you know, because it was Dave's previous group before Nirvana.
Yeah, he was all over D.C. He played a lot of clubs, and I was going to manage Skeeter's band called Soylent Green, but then he took off to Arizona. And because, you know, he had a lot of talent. He was a good front man. But yeah, and he was good, really good friends with David as well. But the Swan Song Records, man, that's, I mean, you had, you know, of course, Zeppelin, Page and Plant, Bad Company, The Pretty Things, right? Dave Edmunds, they were all on that label.
Well, yeah, I was not, by the time the Dave Edmunds record came out, I was going from Swan Song, so I didn't get to work with Dave Edmunds. But the Bad Company, yeah, their first album, Bad Co., was the first album actually on the Swan Song label. And it was incredible. It went to number one, Can't Get Enough of Your Love, the lead track, became a number one single. And I was, quote unquote, an American vice president of Swan Song, so everybody thought I was so smart. I was just very fortunate to work with just talented people, and I tried to do a good job in helping them get on tours in America and get it serviced to the press and radio. But Can't Get Enough of Your Love broke almost as explosively quickly in the, in 1974 or 75 when it came out as Smells Like Teen Spirit did in 91. I mean, that was an explosively big record, and it made everybody involved with it look smarter than we really were.
Danny, how do you get jobs like that? I've been a music journalist, and I do some PR stuff for like 8 years now. How do you make the move from that point to, you know, management and all that?
I mean, well, I mean, everybody does it differently. I can just only describe what happened to me at a time in the past,
right?
And not, it doesn't necessarily mean it would apply to anybody else, you know, in the future. You know, to me, if you do as good a job as you can, whatever the job it is that you're doing, you know, then maybe someone will notice you and want you to do something else. You know, when I worked for Peter Grant, you know, I left Zeppelin's label in 76, and I didn't really have any success as a manager for 10 years. You know, during that 10 years in between, I got PR clients, because that I did have enough of a reputation to get publicity jobs and tried to be a manager, but didn't have any success really at it, or didn't make any money at it till whenever, like you're saying, that Belinda Carlisle record, you know, her first solo record. I'm looking up the date of it, but it was at least 7 or 8 years of not being successful trying to be a manager before I was able to be one. Yeah, 85 is her first solo record, and I leave Zeppelin in 76, and so for that 9 years I was just struggling to pay the rent and, you know, manage some artists, didn't make me much money, like make the bill, and did publicity for people that paid enough that I could stay in the business. But it was just finally I developed enough of a reputation and got lucky with working with the right artists, you know, because we're only as good as the artists we work with, you know, and then they're only as good as commercially as what the public thinks of them. There's an artistic validity that's separate and apart from that, but that doesn't always pay the bills. So I just tried to stay in my lane and one day at a time, and then keep my eyes open for opportunities. And, you know, the main thing to me is not being discouraged by rejection, because everybody who accomplished anything that I know gets rejected quite a few times before things go well for them.
Yeah, I'm also an author, so I know all about that.
I got
a new book out called The Rockstar Chronicles, which has a lot of interviews that I've done over the years. That's in production now, and you know, I got the okay from all the artists while I was interviewing them, but now I had to go back and get the written okay from everybody. That was quite a task.
Oh man. That's why whenever you do a TV show or film a documentary, there's always somebody there having you sign a release at that moment.
Yeah.
So they don't have to go back and do it.
Yeah, I should have done that.
That's why they do that. Next time you know.
Next time I know, exactly. And like 11 guys have passed away, so I don't think I need to get permission for those guys. So,
Yeah, exactly.
Can you love and give a damn about the music and also be a shrewd businessman at the same time?
Yeah.
You know,
not necessarily the same exact minute, but I think you can have both qualities. I think for a lot of people in my line of work, caring about the people you work with and admiring them makes you do a better job. It just brings that extra attention to it. That doesn't mean you lose your ability to do arithmetic.
Right.
You know, or to have common sense about what's going to help or what's not going to help, you know. So, yeah, I think you can those things can coexist. You just have to keep them in balance. You can't let your romantic love of music make you ignore, you know, like I'm saying, you know, paying the rent or,
right.
You know, or how much it costs to travel or things like that. On the other hand, if you're totally only about the numbers, I think you're at a disadvantage because you're less tuned into the emotion that really drives the business, the love of fans for the music. So I think the people that I know that are the most successful have both of those qualities and some sort of balance, and it varies, you know, from person to person how much what the balance is.
Right. See, I think that's what's missing in today's music, though. Is the love of the music, you know?
Oh, I don't think so.
You don't think so?
Older. I think the younger people love it just as much. It's just different kind of music.
Yeah.
And different cast of characters. But I don't really believe the younger people love the music any less than my generation did.
What do you think about music today, the business itself?
Well, I don't understand it as well as I used to understand the business. The touring part of the business I understand because it's basically the same business.
Right.
It's the same business model, which is, you know, people buy tickets and you multiply it by how many people bought the tickets, and that's the pot of money, and then how it's divided up, you know, depends on how much the rent is and the marketing and other things like that. So that's the same business model. But the recorded music business obviously has gone through a complete metamorphosis since I started. And now in the last few years, as the Spotify and Apple and other streaming services are expanding the amount of monthly subscribers, the after 14 years of kind of financial decline as digital world kind of eviscerated and reduced the record sales. The last couple of years now, the total income is starting to creep back up. And so at least you've got some companies taking some risks and hiring some people after, again, 14 years of firing people and taking very few risks. So it's creeping back. I don't have as big a handle on the economics of streaming as I did on selling CDs. My current clients tend to be older artists. I try to do the best job I can for them, but the business is changing so quickly, and the streaming part of it is a little confusing, because there's not as much transparency as there was. People complain about the old record business, but you could get information better about that than you can about all these micropayments today. But a lot of people I work with, you know, the records are a marketing tool, so they can make money licensing their songs for films and commercials, and so they can play concerts and clubs. But there are people, obviously, like Drake and Travis Scott, and, you know, the monster pop songs that have hundreds of millions of streams, and they're making real money from it. And at least there are these companies now with catalogs that are making increased money from them, so there's some investment coming back in for recording. But it's still a much smaller business, the recording part of it, than it was 15 years ago. And the live business, though, is probably bigger. There's these festivals that didn't exist then. There's older audiences that will pay a lot of money for tickets. It's more places in the world you could play, Eastern Europe, Latin America, places that, you know, you couldn't really tour when I started, or good touring markets now. So it's a mixed bag, but, I mean, it's still a very important thing in people's lives. Music is, it bypasses kind of the rational mind and goes to the emotional and spiritual part of people in a way that nothing else quite does, and it creates a sense of community and identity, especially when for people in their kind of early teens and late teens, there's something about what music means to you at that age that's unique in most people's lives. Certainly in my life, there's songs that I loved when I was 15 that just feel different to me than any other songs do. And that's still a business around that. And, you just have to, if you're going to be in the business, learn your piece of it so that you're of some value to the people that make the music and, you know, have a reason to get paid to help them.
Yeah, commercial radio. I mean, being an ex-DJ, and I went to broadcasting school. My school was owned by CBS. I am upset with the commercial radio. I mean, that's why blog radio's gotten so big now. But, you know, it's a shame. You know, I mean, when I went to school, three spots in a row. Anything more than three spots in a row, you're going to lose your audience. And now they've got, what, 8, 9, 10 spots in a row before, and then you forget who you were listening to, you know? Those kind of things.
Well, but it's such a different audience now. Much of the audience is not listening to commercial radio. They're listening to satellite radio, or they're listening to Spotify. So, you know, when you and I started, commercial radio was, for a lot of fans, the only way they could hear music, so there were more fans listening. And it was a totally different business. You had more younger people listening. My kids are in their mid-20s now.
Right.
And I don't think they ever listened to commercial radio much. By the time they were, you know, kind of focusing on music, there were other ways of hearing music without commercial. So the commercial radio is for a smaller and smaller universe of people who can't afford any of these other things. And it tends to be more limited in its offerings. And there's exceptions. There's parts of the country where there's some dynamic commercial radio stations that are still kind of creatively introducing music to people, but very few of them, because most people are being introduced to music by whether it's YouTube or Spotify, or, you know, their friends turning them on to things. So so the record business went through a gigantic change with the digital one, but obviously so did the radio business. So radio is now more for things that are live, like news and sports, that, you know, or talk radio or things like that, for commercial radio. Other than that, you know, you've got podcasts, you've got satellite, you've got streaming services, you've got so many other sources of audio entertainment that commercial radio is just shrunk. It still has a role, especially, like I said, for news and sports, but it's nothing compared to what it was before all these other alternatives came along.
Yeah, it's very different the way they have to get exposure now. It's either YouTube or the artists I talk to say you got to get out there and play live. That's the only way you're going to be recognized. But
well, playing live for the kind of musicians I work with, that's the first thing I look for.
Right.
You know, there are people that do it other ways, you know, digitally. But you know, the live connection to me is still the base of the kind of music that I love.
Right.
And it's also the business, you know, for a lot of the artists that, you know, that I love. But you still have to market that.
Sure.
And that involves, you know, there's non-commercial radio, there's satellite, there's podcasts, there's these blogs, there's still what's left of the press, there's still a few TV opportunities, and you just have, depending on what kind of music, some of them, you know, dance music emerges sometimes still in clubs. But, you know, that's just every year, whatever the tools are at the moment, you use them, and they change from decade to decade.
How many artists do you have on your roster right now?
I think it's like 8. It's a pretty small company. There's just 4 of us. It's a boutique company. I've been spending half my time writing books, like you mentioned. You know, two of these books have come out in the last 3 years. So, you know, we have, as I said, there's 4 of us in the office, and we represent Steve Earle, who I started the company around, a dozen years ago, and he was the first client. Just started working with the Water Boys, have a new album out. Betty Labette, great blues and R&B artist. Ben Lee, Australian artist who lives in L.A., Martha Wainwright, and 3 or 4 others. So it's 8 or 9. You know, it's usually a ratio of 2 or 3 artists to 1. So it's what you call, you know, again, it's a boutique company, but fortunately our artists do well enough live, both here and in Europe and other places, that we can keep our doors open, and I still get to do this. And, you know, it does give me some time to do the writing, which, as I've gotten older, has really been really emotionally important to me, and I'm happy that the books have done well enough that they, you know, I can keep getting them published.
Congratulations, by the way, but for not getting a ghostwriter and doing it yourself. That's important.
You know, I just never considered getting a ghostwriter. I respect that some people, to get their story out, that's the right way to do it.
Yep.
But I started as a journalist when I was... I wrote for the high school newspaper. Mm-hmm. It's the only thing I was kind of any good at in high school. And I started as a journalist, and my idea, I really like writing it myself, and that's the only way I can feel good about it. Again, there's nothing wrong with having a co-writer. A lot of terrific books come out that way. I mean, I love Keith Richards' memoir. He had a great co-writer and so on. But for me, it's about the writing. It's, you know, I love to read. I'm trying to become a better writer as I get older. And I do every word of it myself, you know.
I think it's awesome. The only thing with writing, it takes so much of your time. The last book I wrote took 3.5 years. It's a story about me growing up in the family business in D.C. And it's, you know, it's kind of funny and everything, but it, you know, it's all you think about. You know, you dream about it. It's your day, you know?
I've liked this about the last few years. I've done two of them. I'm trying to think of another one now. By the end of the summer, hopefully I'll have a proposal out. But you gotta do it every day. You don't have to do it all day every day, but for me, if I don't write something every day, I kinda lose the muscle. It's the way some people feel about exercising.
Right, right.
But if you can get into a groove of spending a couple hours a day on it, you can get things done.
Sure.
But you have to do something every day, not necessarily the same amount of time every day. And after a couple hours, 2-3 hours is all I can do, and then my brain just is fried.
Right.
But the challenge to me is to get into the habit of doing it every day. And when I fall out of that habit, it's not good. But if I can stay in that habit, then things can get done. I'm going to try to stay in that mode as the business side is. Again, I love having the management company, but, you know, I have the time, given that it's a small company, to do this other thing. I try to keep it in balance. Yeah, clients come first. Those are the first calls I return, you know, because I'm working for them. But I do have the time to do this the last few years, so I expect to be able to keep doing it.
Have you thought about writing maybe something fictional?
You know, I've tried in the past, and I may revisit it. I'm a big fan of detective fiction, and if I did do anything,
right,
I think the first thing would be in that realm. But my experiments with it in the past, when I would reread the stuff, it was just so lame. I just was mortified. I have more confidence in writing nonfiction, but I have had this thing in the back of my mind for years that maybe I'll go back to a kind of a murder mystery type thing. But I don't know that would be the next thing I would do. I'm a little intimidated by that. I'm less intimidated by nonfiction. I think I've figured out a style of researching and writing nonfiction that works for me, at least, and that's the first thing that's going to work for you before you can expect to work for anyone else.
Yeah, I'm a nonfiction guy, too, but I do have ideas. You know?
Oh, no, I have ideas. It's just been, I have not been able to accomplish something that I didn't feel bad about when I read it.
Yeah.
But I might try again. It's definitely a possibility that I might try again. But the nonfiction, I feel more confident about.
Danny, I'm assuming you have some Jewish roots in you, right?
Yeah, my name is Goldberg. That's a pretty good guess. You know, I was not brought up religious, but my parents were both, culturally Jewish,
right.
and I certainly honor that, the tradition. I spiritually believe that all the religions basically lead to the same place,
sure.
And I don't feel closer at this time in my life to Judaism than I do to Christianity or Hinduism or Buddhism or just, you know, unnameable set of values and all that stuff, but I was brought up in that in that cultural tradition, although again my family was not religious. Me and my brother were not Bar Mitzvah, for example, but I do have those roots. Yeah,
I did a DNA test because my father's parents, they were Syrian Jews, and I found out through the DNA testing that I'm half Italian. Because I guess they were ousted from Spain originally, and they went to Italy. So that was quite a surprise. The Jews in Italy.
I don't know if I had any interest in doing that. I guess I kind of have a more mystical idea about, you know, the soul. And to me, DNA is just a suit that we're wearing. You know, it's not
right.
Who our ultimate self is. But
yeah.
God, millions of people get a lot out of that process. So it's definitely part of the world that we live in today, that they can identify that stuff. Now, How long did you have to do this? Because I had figured we'd be done by around 4, and we're getting close to that.
Danny, I'm done. Is there anything else you need to promote or chat about?
No, I'm so grateful to talk to you about all this stuff. It's much more interesting than a lot of the conventional interviews I've done, because it's a more freewheeling conversation, which is a lot more fun for me. So I thank you for that. And I thank you for plugging the book. So, you know, I hope we cross paths again soon.
Danny, if any of your artists need a little PR, give me a call. We'll put them on the air, okay?
Noted. Thanks, man.
All right, man. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Serving the Servant, Remembering Kurt Cobain by Danny Goldberg, can be purchased now at Amazon.com. For more information about Danny Goldberg, visit www.goldve.com. Also, if you want to find out more information about Nirvana, www.nirvana.com. Very special thanks today to Roxanne Lim for arranging this interview with Danny Goldberg. And, of course, the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsome of BBS Radio for making the magic happen for each and every broadcast of Interviewing Legends. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com. And please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Interviewing the Legends with Ray Shasho, for the very latest interviews. It's real news, people. And don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and the Wacky Family Business, available now at Amazon.com. You will live it. And coming soon, The Rockstar Chronicles. Be looking out for that by Ray Shasho. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio, Station 1.